I will be preaching out of the first seven verses of chapter 4 of 1 Corinthians. If you're in a home group, you've been looking at this chapter this last week. And I'm just going to take seven verses of it because I think in many ways they embody the whole burden of the book that we call 1 Corinthians, but certainly the fourth chapter. And I want to start off by doing something that I think the Apostle Paul probably would not approve of. I want to ask the question, what did he look like? Now, that's irrelevant if we're just thinking about the message, what he looked like, but I think it gives us some color, and there is an apocryphal description of Paul, probably written about 100 years after his death, that I'm sure he looks exactly like this. Now, whether or not he does doesn't affect the message, but I do think it gives us some color. From the apocryphal Acts of Paul, about 100 years after his death, says this about how he looked. A little man with a big, bold head. His legs were crooked, but his bearing was noble. His eyebrows grew close together, and he had a big nose. A man who breathed friendliness. I'm sure that's exactly what he looked like. And again, not that it's important for the message, although I think it gives us some color. Paul's traveling companion for a good chunk of his ministry that we have in the New Testament was a man named Barnabas. And there's an incident that happens, and it's recorded in Acts chapter 14, where Paul and Barnabas are in the town of Lystra. There's a man who is crippled, and they pray for his healing, and he's healed. And the townspeople are ecstatic. They come out to worship Paul and Barnabas. And they looked at them, and they thought, Barnabas, why, he must be the incarnation of Zeus. Now, if you've looked at any statues of Zeus from classical Greece, Greek statuary, he was tall. He had a square jaw, he was good-looking, he had gravitas, because he was kind of the king of the gods. So it's reasonable to assume Barnabas was probably really good-looking and very attractive. And they looked at Paul, who was doing most of the talking, and said, that must be his son Hermes. Now, if you know your Greek mythology, Hermes was the son of Zeus and his wife. And Hermes was a messenger and the god of merchants, thieves, and oratory. So they say, oh, but Zeus and Hermes have showed up. And Paul, it would seem, especially as we look at the fourth chapter of 1 Corinthians, he does not look like your Greek ideal. Of a man. And in fact, he makes a big deal out of the fact that the things that the Greeks appreciated so much was eloquence and the powers of persuasion. These were raw democracies. You had a lot of power if you could talk people into believing what you were saying. And please don't read too much of that against the background of the debates we've been watching on TV. But a persuasive orator was a very powerful person. And so Paul, he kind of eschews that. He lets us know right away, I didn't try to play that card, and probably because he couldn't. They even complained about his preaching. So here we have Paul. Again, you don't have to buy into this description, but it just works for me. And what was he like? Well, if you read the New Testament enough, you'll develop a profile for Paul. I want to read you what one church historian, Paul Johnson, says about the man Paul. Now, I don't agree with everything he said about him, but I think he gets at kind of the force that he was. And I quote, Paul, a massive personality, eager, adventurous, tireless, voluble, that means talkative. A man who struggles heroically for truth and then delivers it in uncontrollable excitement, hurrying ahead of his powers of articulation. Not a man easy to work with or confute in an argument or rebuke into silence or to advance a compromise. A dangerous, angular, unforgettable man. Now, that hits on a lot of things that just resonate with me as the years I've read Paul's letters and memorized portions of them. Not a man to confute in an argument. And a man who gets so excited about the truth, there's times that he almost stumbles over himself to get it out of his mouth. There are portions of Paul's letters that seem to be one continuous sentence because Paul is so stoked about it, what he has to say. So Paul is dealing with this church in Corinth. It's a problematic church. They have fan clubs. My gosh, fan clubs in the church? Well, some people say, I'm with Peter. And others say, well, I'm with Apollos. And of course, Apollos is a Greek name, and he was noted for his learned, theologically profound mind. Kind of fits the Greek ideal. I'm with Peter. I'm with Apollos. And then the really, and some say, I'm with Paul. But then the really spiritual people say, well, I'm with Jesus. Well, this is ridiculous, says Paul. And he has to direct all of his powers of persuasion and authority as he addresses this. He's been talking about it for the first three chapters, but the fourth chapter begins with these words. And he picks out Apollos as an illustration, along with him, of what he wants them to understand. So again, a church full of fan clubs, culturally captive to persuasiveness and learnedness. So he says, and I quote, so look at Apollos and me as mere servants of Christ who have been put in charge of explaining God's mysteries. Now, a person who's put in charge as a manager must be faithful. And as for me, it matters very little how I might be evaluated by you or any human authority. I don't even trust my own judgment on this point. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't prove I'm right. It is the Lord himself who will examine me and decide. So don't make judgments about anyone ahead of time. Now, when is that? Before the Lord returns. For he will bring our darkest secrets to light and will reveal our private motives. Then God will give to each one whatever praise is due. And now he gets heated. Now, dear brothers and sisters, I have used Apollos and myself to illustrate what I've been saying. If you pay attention to what I've quoted from the scriptures, you won't be proud of one of your leaders at the expense of another. And then he asks a series of rhetorical questions, and he is hot. What gives you the right to make such a judgment? And what do you have that God didn't first give to you? And if he gave it to you, if everything you have is from God, why do you boast as though it was not a gift? Just piercing, angry, righteously so, questions about who do you think you are doing this? So Paul, I would not say he had a thick skin. And we'll find out later in the letters that he's been criticized for his preaching ability. Think of it. What if the man who wrote most of the New Testament had been your pastor for a few years? And you're sitting around saying, well, he's okay. writes good letters, but he's not much in the pulpit. So Paul is dealing with this kind of thing. So what do you do with criticism? And that's what I want to talk about this morning, how Paul responds to the critics and to the people who are really not very appreciative of him. Now, think about criticism for a moment. You've all, I'm sure, been criticized before. And if some of us have been more public in our ministries or in our vocations, and we get good letters, we get bad letters. I remember one television personality who got a lot of letters, and some of them were really angry and hateful. And the way he dealt with his criticism, he had a form letter he would send back to the person who wrote the angry letter. So he would send the letter he got from them back to them with a note which said, and I quote, "The enclosed letter arrived on my desk a few days ago. I'm sending it back to you in the belief that as a responsible citizen, you should know that some idiot is sending out letters over your signature. Well, you know, I thought, that's really good. Have you had the experience where you've been criticized and you had an argument and then you think about it for days and you lay in bed and you're doing replays, what you could have said. You could have devastated them. Well, Paul, who is clearly upset about this, and I think that's okay, he responds with a beautifully balanced theological and spiritual rationale that apply to all of us. Three things you need to know about dealing with criticism. You need to know who you belong to in the first place. Secondly, who is your judge? And thirdly, there is a day of judgment coming, and everyone will get their day in court. So let's think about each one of these. First of all, you need to remember who you belong to. Look at Apollos and me as mere servants of Christ. The word that's translated mere servants is literally under rower in the Greek. And it was often applied to these three-tiered battleships that the Greeks and Romans would have. And the rowers are on the lowest level. And they're down there. It's sweaty. It's hard work. And they're at the lowest level, but the one distinction they have down there, rowing the ship, was they were closest to the captain's voice. So Paul said, now, okay, Apollos, okay, Paul, we are under rowers in the ship. We're just mere servants who have been put in charge of explaining God's mysteries. Again, the word translated put in charge, I'm reading actually out of the New Living Translation, is a word which, behind our English word, economy. Stewards of a household. We have been given what belongs to God, and we have been charged with the task of managing what belongs to God in His interests. Well, what have they been given the charge of managing? Well, what a job. Their job is to explain the mysteries of God. What a job. Besides, you know, we're really not much, but what we do is we're down there. In fact, we're scorned by the world and some of you. And our job is to give a faithful explanation of God's truth. So the guy once, who was a wonderful preacher, and we were speaking at a conference at Forest Home, and I remember he came into my cabin before he was going to preach, and he's a Welshman, and has a wonderful accent, and I remember his hands were literally trembling as he held his sermon notes. He says, "This is so good." Well, you know, I don't know what people thought of his sermon. I thought it was great. But the point was, he had this great sense of humility. I get to talk about God. And so, my only standard of success then is how faithful have I been? This is God's truth. Have I been faithful? You probably know the name of St. Thomas Aquinas, a 12th and 13th century theologian, a great man. He wrote the Summa Theologica. It's one of the greatest intellectual achievements of all time. It's probably the last time anyone in Western civilization attempted to have a unified view of all truth. It's about art, science, literature, ethics, psychology, 38 treatises, 3,000 articles, 10,000 objections. He wrote this massive work. And on December 6th, 1273, near the end of his life, he celebrated Mass at the chapel of St. Nicholas. His assistant stayed outside. Aquinas went in by himself to worship Christ. And he was in there. He was inside quite a while. And as Reginald, his assistant, tells the story, he virtually staggered out of the chapel because he had had a vision of Christ. And what would you say if you saw him? Well, Aquinas said, again, this man who wrote the Summa Theologica, his first thought was, "Lord, have I spoken well of you?" That's all that matters. Did I do my job? And then he was given a vision of the glory of heaven and of God's presence. And he stammered to describe it. He didn't try too long to Reginald. But he said this. He said, "I can do no more. Such things have been revealed to me that all I have written seems to me as so much straw." Oh, man. I'm a writer. I know my stuff is straw. But Aquinas? "Now I await the end of my life, and after that, the end of my works." And he didn't write anymore. This is what I did. Jesus said, "Did a good job." That's all he needed to do. So in summary on this one, we're defined not by who we are in ourselves, ever, but who we belong to. There's a new book out called Look Up Before You Look In. Good title. Look Up Before You Look In. It's by Trevin Wax. And I read a review, and I read part of what he wrote about the book in the review. He said, "Recent studies show that 91% of Americans agree with this statement." Okay, 91% of our fellow Americans agree with this statement. Quote, "The best way to find yourself is by looking within yourself." That is the number one best way most Americans believe you find yourself. And Wax writes about that. In other words, if you want to discover who you are and what your purpose is, the place to look is inside your heart. You look inside for the answers. Trust your heart. Go with your gut. No one else gets to define you. This is the looking in approach to life. The freedom to feel when you see in your life this way can be mesmerizing. You get to determine your own destiny. You're free to define your gender, your sexual preference. You can define yourself however you want, and you don't have to change for anybody because you feel it. You see it in your heart. I call this the Hallmark Channel Credo. Now, I only watch it because Loretta likes to watch it. No, I like it, you know, but if there's one big message in the Hallmark Channel, you know, it's look in your heart. Look in your heart. Well, it's not as entertaining as the Hallmark Channel, but it's truer. Heidelberg Catechism, question 1. What is your only comfort in life and in death? This is gospel. The answer is, my only comfort in life and in death is that I'm not my own, but belong body and soul in life and in death to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ, who has fully paid for all my sins with his precious blood and set me free from the tyranny of the devil, and who watches over me in such a way that not a hair can fall from my head without the will of my Father in heaven. That's your only comfort, that you're not your own. Well, Paul, he starts off his response to their critical spirit by saying, well, you know, I belong to him. He's the commander, and I only try to please him, which is the second thing that Paul commends for us to deal with criticism. Remember, who's your judge? Now, he had to say this he wrote it, but he had to have said this with a defiant tone in his voice. As for me, it matters very little how I might be evaluated by you or by any human authority. I don't even trust my own judgment on this point. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't prove I'm right. It is the Lord himself who will examine me and decide. And what he goes on to say is, I don't care what you think. And, you know, I don't care what I think either. The only one whose opinion matters is Christ's. And in effect, he says, and he hasn't said anything yet. He said, don't make judgments ahead of time. Wait till the Lord comes back, and then you'll find out. Well, I remember reading this the first time, and I thought, well, I was in a very difficult church I was pastoring, and they were very critical. And I remember how I relished reading these words to the church. You know? I don't care what you think. And then I read, you know, studies about pastors, and there's some generalizations you can make about people in ministry. We tend to be people who are people pleasers. We want to be liked. And that's true of more than, that is one of the singular characteristics of people in Christian ministry. And I thought, well, that's not me, because I don't care. It's like Ricky Nelson with that song, Garden Party, you know, said, you know, you can't please everyone, so you might as well please yourself. I'm kind of that way, y'all. And I thought, well, yeah, I don't get pushed around. But, you know, both people-pleasing and being kind of an independent, cussed guy like me, we're both idolaters. Because my opinion doesn't matter about me, nor does your opinion matter about me, and vice versa. It only belongs to the judge, the only righteous judge. And so there's freedom in that. I wish my son were here to hear me tell the story about him, Joel. When he was in his first year playing soccer, you know, he's 6, 7 years old or something like that. We called it, you know, swarm ball. Yeah, no one ever scores. It's just kids just swarming around. And so Joel was in his first year of playing, you know, AYSO. And so this is one of the last games. It was 0-0, but there was one kid on the other team who was precocious physically. And I guess he just got frustrated. We got to score, and I'm going to score. So he was a big kid, and he was very coordinated, and he started going in a straight line down the middle of the field. And the other little kids were just parting like the Red Sea. And he just was going straight. And guess who was playing goalie? Joel. And I'm watching him. And Joel's seen this happen. Guys are just falling back to the side, and he's heading straight for Joel. He wasn't going to dodge. He wasn't going to try to sneak around him. And Joel just stood his ground, and there was a huge collision. The ball went up in the air. The big kid got penalized. And Joel, he's on his face. It's dirt all over him, you know, and sweat, you know. And the first thing he does is he leans up and he looks at me. What do you think, Dad? Well, okay. That's not trivial. He wanted to know what his dad thought. And brothers and sisters, we only should worry what our Savior thinks. Now, maybe you're asking the question, how can I get to the place where I care more about what God thinks than others think about me, or I think about me? Well, it's an acquired taste. It really is. It happens over a lifetime of worship, of Bible study, of Christian fellowship, of training your affections. The song we'll sing after the message this morning, Psalm 34:8. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Well, it's just a lifetime of tasting and developing, acquiring that affection. Maybe my favorite verse is Psalm 27:4. One thing I ask of the Lord, like that one thing, is that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. So how do you get to where you care more about what God thinks than you think about what you think, or someone else does? By looking at him. John Piper has a great one-liner on it. He says, beholding is becoming. In the third chapter of 2 Corinthians, Paul says, and we who with unveiled faces all behold the Lord's glory are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which is from the Lord. So how do you get to care more about what God thinks? Well, find out more about God. Gaze at him. Be changed. There's a famous sermon in the 19th century by Thomas Chalmers. It's called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. And he was really addressing this question. How do you get to really care about what God thinks and who he is? Well, by gazing on God. And he used two Greek myths to illustrate his point. In the myth of Odysseus, or Ulysses, when he was in Homer's, you know, epic, he's trying to get back home, and they sail past the island of the Sirens. The sirens were these demonic creatures, but they looked like beautiful women, and they sang beautiful songs. And sailors would sail through this very narrow passageway, and just off the island, and they would hear the music. They would see these gorgeous women singing to them, and they could not help themselves. They just would leap over the side of the boat, and they'd all die in whirlpools and be dashed upon the rocks. And Odysseus knew this. So when they had to walk, go by the island, he had all of his sailors, he plugged their ears, and then he said, tie me to the mast, and you won't be able to hear it, and if I'm there tied to the mast, no matter how much I beg you, no matter how much I plead for you to let me get out and get to where they are, you don't let me go. So they did that. Their ears were plugged, he was tied to the mast, and they got through safely. And Chalmers said, now, some kind of Christians kind of go about that way. They just, you just hold on tight, you know. But there was another myth that illustrates what I think is more, well, it's equally biblical. It's Morpheus. He was a musician. And he played beautiful music. And he played such beautiful music that when he went by the island of the sirens, his music was more lovely than the lies that were being sung. So there are these three classic categories of Christian ethics. What's true, what's good, and what's beautiful. Well, what's true is beautiful. What's good is beautiful. You put them together. Well, that's what it means to care about what God thinks. And then finally, you remember, there will be a judgment. You will get your day in court. And, well, sometimes I'm not sure I want that day in court. But I think the way Paul speaks of it is really inviting. Verse 5, so don't make judgments about anyone ahead of time before the Lord returns. So apparently, if we make judgments about each other before he comes back, we're premature. For he will bring our darkest secrets to light and will reveal our private motives. Then God will give to each one whatever praise is due. Do away with prejudgment, prejustice, prejudice. And it would seem that the Lord cares more about our motives than about our performance. He reveals our hidden motives. So I thought about it. Why would God ever be impressed with anything I do, any performance I might do? I'm preaching a sermon right now. Well, I hope it pleases the Lord, but come on, he's heard better preachers than me. He's a better preacher than I am. But what God is looking at and what he reveals to us is why we do what we do. And so there's a bite in these words. He says, for what gives you the right to make judgments about each other? What do you have that God hasn't given to you? And if everything you have is from God, why boast as if it were not a gift? So do away with prejudice or prejudgment and to wait in hope, because it says, he will give to each one whatever praise is due. So I'm going to close with a true story. And I think it embodies everything I've tried to preach the last 25 minutes. A few years back, I was invited to speak at the Christian Medical and Dental Society conference in Asia. It was near Singapore. And it was a gathering of Christian doctors and dentists who were serving in mission fields. And I was there to give 2 weeks of Bible studies, and they had seminars and did all kinds of neat things. It was a great experience. And there was a retired missionary doctor they were going to honor at this gathering. His name was Norval Christie. Now, Norval, he was quite a man. He had graduated from one of the Ivy League college medical schools as an ophthalmologist. And he thought before he went into private practice in the U.S. and became really rich, he would go to Pakistan and do eye surgeries, because there's tremendous problems with blindness and things in that climate and in that place in the world. So he would spend a year doing that and then come back and, you know, set up his practice. Well, he never left. And after, I don't know, 35, 40 years of doing eye surgeries in Pakistan, he'd have to get up at 3 in the morning and start surgeries at 4, and they'd have to quit by 10 because it was so hot. They didn't have enough sutures. They started using fishing line. And he had a better rate of recidivism. I mean, his surgeries worked than even over here in the U.S. So, you know, 30, 40 years of wonderful service, and he was slated to be given an award for distinguished service, and he was going to give a speech on the relationship between medicine and the gospel or something like that. It was kind of a highfalutin, you know, special thing, and I was really excited to hear this. This man was a great man. He's going to do some theology about, you know, being a doctor and serving Christ and among the poor. And so he got up to speak that night to get his award, and he gave a devotion on the feeding of the 5,000 about a boy who had his lunch, you know, lunch pail, 5 loaves, 2 fish, and the Lord fed 5,000 with his lunch. And so Christy said, that's kind of what I did. All right. I was disappointed. I wanted to hear something profound, and I didn't think I heard it. And in fact, I went to bed that night, and I said to Loretta, I said, you know, gosh, I thought he was going to do something that ought to be published, you know, not a devotional on feeding 5,000 with your lunch. So I got up the next morning, and I went down to the dining room to get some coffee. So we started talking, and he said, yeah, you know, he was retiring in Pasadena. And says, last year, someone gave me tickets to the Rose Bowl. So I went to the game, and I looked around. There were 100,000 people there. And I thought, you know, in the 30 or 40 years I spent doing eye surgeries, I didn't do much more than what was sitting there in that stadium. Much more than that. I guess all you ever do, ever, is give your lunch to Jesus. Then I got the message. Who do you belong to? Oh, the Lord. What do you have that he didn't first give you? Nothing. What do you do with it? Well, you use it to serve him. And who will judge how well you did? Well, the gracious God who gave you the gifts in the first place. I like to think, this is totally outside scripture now, I like to think that that boy who gave his lunch to Jesus that day, since I am a grandpa, one day he kind of gathered his grandchildren around him, and with a twinkle in his eye, he said, can I tell you about the day I fed 5,000 people with my lunch? You guys, you never know how important it is to give Jesus your lunch and not compare yourself to somebody else, but just strive to please the one who gave you everything you have. And if we need to confess anything, we need to confess, Lord, forgive me for treating what I have as though I put it together, me, myself, and I. And I wish I were like that guy over there who's done it better than I have. The great apostle said, who gives you the right to think that way? Not God. When you meet him face to face, I think the sweetest words we'll ever hear, and I long to hear them, is, well done, faithful servant. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.